There is certainly more to candy than a sugary taste. As the new book Sweet as Sin, the unwrapped story of how candy became America's favorite pleasure shows, candy has a remarkable history, most of it sweet, some of it bitter. Susan Benjamin, a food historian and candy expert, tells the story from the harvesting of the marshmallow plant in ancient Egypt to the mass-produced candy innovations of the 20th century. Again, the title of the book is Sweet as Sin, and we welcome Susan Benjamin to the roundtable this morning. Susan, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
It is fascinating to me that there have not been more books written about our love affair with candy.
Right. And it's an interesting thing because if you ask people what they think of candy, they have a lot of responses. It's a real mixed reaction. But it doesn't seem that anybody really takes it too seriously. And because of that and the reasons why they don't take it seriously, I don't think there's been a huge amount of research into the universe of sweet sugars and ultimately candy.
And do you get a sense of why that is?
Well, yeah, I was hoping you would ask. The reason is, it's complex, but one of the reasons is that candy really came into being in the mid-1800s when sugar prices dropped, machinery picked up, and now all of a sudden people could do really imaginative things with food. It also made food, in the case of sugar and candy, more accessible to working class and the much maligned children of immigrants. So these kids could go into stores, they could buy candy for a few pennies and basically enter the middle class, as well as participate in the life of the cane sugar, which was, of course, a really privileged life. So the well-to-do got upset. And they it's just really amazing. They wrote these very strong responses to what candy was all about. They would say things like it killed kids. They blamed candy on the polio epidemic. I mean, you name it. Candy was the villainous food. And that aura, you could say, remains with us today.
One of the things that you get the sense of in the book is that because candy has been around for so long, and because you, even in this history, you go back so far, I guess one of the things that you had to do, as it seems in the book, is come up with a definition of exactly what we consider candy to be.
Yeah, that's true. I think if you're looking at the history of candy, then you can go back to the ingredients that are in candy and how they became what we know today, which is what I did. If you wanted to be really strict about it, then I think you're pretty much looking at the mid-1800s, as I mentioned. But can we take a look at chewing gum for a second?
Absolutely.
Okay, so chewing gum began from the tree, and I mean literally from the tree. All around the world, people have chewed tree resins to clean their teeth, to use as a medicine. The oldest example is from Sweden 9,000 years ago, which, with great poetic license, I think it's really funny. Researchers found that this chewing gum had teeth marks in it, which belonged to a Neanderthal teenager. So even then, a Neanderthal teenager was chewing the gum and spitting it out somewhere. However, in the New England area where you're based and where your listeners are primarily based, we have the spruce resin. And the Native Americans of the area chewed that resin. They carried it with them on long hikes and so forth. And a guy later on in the 1800s named John Curtis, a fascinating guy, wound up taking that spruce resin and turning it into a commercial item, which remained a viable chewing gum, the first and a long-lasting chewing gum, through the early 1900s.
You write very early in the book that when sugar cane made its way to North America, the ground didn't shake, but it should have. It had quite an effect.
It did. So today, most people consider cane sugar the prevailing sugar and believe when they're eating candy or dessert or adding it to the tea that it's made out of cane. That isn't true. Most of the history of sugar in this country is about the maple. It's about the boiled barks. It's about the fruits. But the cane was unique because it was the reason for slavery. And it defined the lives of those who were enslaved at so many levels. It's remarkable. Without the cane sugar, you can say we would not have enslavement in this country. There'd be no need for it. If I can take it one step further, the extent of that was so much so that the abolitionists boycotted cane sugar, not only for moral reasons, but for economic ones. Their thinking is, if we devastate the economy of cane sugar, then we devastate the economy of enslavement. We don't need slaves anymore, and they would be free. It's really remarkable.
And one of the things that during that time, as the abolitionists had their very strong feelings about sugarcane production, of course, the first thing you look for is an alternative. Maple was one of those alternatives.
Maple was one of the alternatives. And, of course, the Native Americans used maple in many ways. They would form a really tight little brick of maple, but they also would use it in molds and so forth. But there were other sugars that they had to rely on instead of the maple because, as anybody who makes maple syrup today knows, it's a really long, really seasonal process. It's a difficult process. So what they brought in were things such as the sorghum grain, as well as the beet sugar. And those were invaluable because they grow in cold climates. And today you find them in Minnesota and in Michigan and, you know, various parts of the cooler regions. And that meant that the Northerners and the abolitionists would not have to rely on the cane sugar at all. And, of course, as I mentioned, it could devastate, potentially devastate the economy of the cane. But more importantly, as the Civil War drew near, it made it so that they could keep using sugar and have that as a resource, which, by the way, the beet sugar today is over 50%, around 55% of the sugar that Americans eat. It looks like cane sugar. It's granulated, but it's actually beet.
So let us then talk about the, as we talk about things that come onto the scene and shake the world to its core, chocolate certainly did that.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about how chocolate came to this country and to such prominence.
Well, to such prominence is a good way to put it, because the Native Americans of what we now consider the Southwest likely had the chocolate. It originated, as people know, as the cacao with the Aztec, and most famously Montezuma, who was said to have 50 or something like that chalices of chocolate each day. Probably didn't, but it, you know, maybe some, but not that much. That's one of the many myths of Montezuma. It wound up going from there with the Spanish to Spain, where it was hidden away. They didn't want anybody else having chocolate because it was so valuable and they thought it was so amazing. The Inquisition sort of helped the migration along a bit. Jews from Spain wound up taking it into France, in a very small, isolated part of France, and there they started making wonderful chocolate goods. It went from there into France and all around the world via the relationship of royalty. So as one royal family married into another in various parts of Europe, they wound up taking the chocolate with them. And ultimately, chocolate production took on its own in Massachusetts with the renowned Baker family. And they were, of course, in Dorchester, Mass. And it wasn't a chocolate for Bakers, but it was a chocolate called Baker's chocolate because it belonged to the Baker family.
I'm a Pennsylvania boy, so you write in the book about a lot about chocolate and the Pennsylvania connection, both of course with Hershey, but also with the Wilbur Chocolate Company and Wilbur's Buds.
Yes. Do you want me to talk about Wilbur Buds a bit?
You do, because you went on a road trip to get to the source.
Yes, I did. I went on many road trips, and most of them were in Massachusetts, but the one in Pennsylvania was just, oh my gosh, I can't tell you how fascinating these stories are. And of course, I went into greater detail in the book, but with the Wilbur Bud, the Wilbur Bud started in the late 1800s, but the Wilbur Company started in the 1860s. And later on, they had as a neighbor Milton Hershey. And Hershey actually copied the Bud in making what they call the Hershey Kiss. The Hershey Kiss, actually, the Kiss is a name of a kind of candy and was not specific to Hershey at all. The look of it, really, he did get from the Wilbur family, and he also got the wrap, the foil wrap from them as well. The Wilbur family was not really hurt by Hershey's adopting, let's say, their Bud. They still make it today, but they were making chocolate for other companies. And ironically, today, the Wilbur Company makes chocolate for Hershey's. Not all of their chocolates, but some of them.
You do write in the book about penny candy. And of course, this is something that so many of us have grown up with. And the first thing we realize as children is, oh, it's not actually a penny, but it's several pennies. But that's okay.
Yeah.
Why did that explode in this country?
Well, penny candy really was for a penny, and it really was inexpensive. And it exploded because, as I mentioned before, the working-class kids had access to it, as did all other kids. It was available, it was cheap, it was fun, and marketers were really getting adept at selling things, so they were able to take whatever happened to be around, it seems, and turn it into a candy for kids that they could buy by the bagful. When I was a kid, a lot of those really were a penny, and it was just this magical, magical item. Can I tell you what the first penny candy was, though?
Absolutely.
It's an absolute shock, and New Englanders are familiar with it, as are people in other parts of the country. It's the Necco wafer. That was made, just incredible story, it was made in 1847 by a guy named Oliver Chase, who was a pharmacist in Boston, then later moved to Cambridge. And he was looking for a way to cut pills in even slices and to create doses in the process as well as manufacture them. So it was a way of speeding up the process of making pills and making them predictable. And he succeeded at that. At the time, he was also taking the medicine out of the pills so that people could enjoy it as a candy. That became known as the Hub wafer, Boston being the hub, or the Chase lozenge. His brother made another candy, and with that one, he more or less used the same batter as Oliver, but he took a little stamp. He invented a little stamp-making machine, and he took that, and he stamped sayings onto the candy, and that became the conversation heart you see on Valentine's Day. But they came out of the apothecaries, and my sources were articles written in the turn of the century. And they were articles where the authors either knew the Chase brothers or their parents knew the Chase brothers, and they were familiar firsthand with the origins. And they proclaimed the virtues of Oliver Chase and his confection and what it did for medicine. It's really amazing. And as I said, it was the beginning of the inexpensive penny candies we know today.
When we think of inexpensive candy, I guess we still look at the candy bar as one way of getting our fix, right?
I would say so.
Yeah. And the candy bar has been with us for a long time.
Well, the candy bar actually started in around 1847 also, but over in England with the Fry family. Then it was adopted by folks in the U.S., in particular in your native Pennsylvania with Milton Hershey, who added an almond to it, and that gave it a kind of real panache, and people were buying those for a nickel. But the candy bar, as we know it today, i.e. the combination candy bar, really started in 1912. And that was with something called the Goo Goo Cluster, made in Nashville, still made in Nashville today. Then the Clark Bar, which people are familiar with. It was actually made by an immigrant from Ireland, as well as his other candy bar, the Zagnut, and many others, which really took off. And the reason they took off was that David Clark, as well as a guy whose last name was Goldenberg, and made the peanut chew, they were smart enough to send their candy bars off to World War I. And they were in the first rations ever in the country. The Doughboys came back, and they said they love those candy bars, and everybody should be getting them. And they created basically a demand for candy bars, which took off. During the Depression, the candy makers were having trouble getting sugar because of sugar shortages. And so what they did is they marketed their candy bars as an inexpensive meal in a bar. And they really promoted them as an important food. So they got hold of the sugar. There was a reason for them to have it. And that identity of the candy bar as an inexpensive meal in a bar is with us today. And it has new forms, and those would be the granola bar, the health food bar, the diet bar, ironically, with all that caramel and chocolate chips in it, the protein bar, the Clif bar. They owe their existence to the candy bar, and very directly so, and many of them are pretty much a candy bar. If you pick up your average on-the-shelf candy bar and compare them to the health bars, they're very similar.
Well, the book is fascinating. It's so interesting to read about this story of candy. The book is Sweet as Sin, the unwrapped story of how candy became America's favorite pleasure. It is published by Prometheus Books. Susan Benjamin, what a delight. Thank you so much for being with us. I do appreciate it.
Oh, happy to be here.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Sweet as Sin. It's published by Prometheus Books by Susan Benjamin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.